Hello and welcome to Changing the Record, the podcast brought to you by the Talking About My Generation news team, who are setting the record straight on growing older in Greater Manchester.
Couple with Carol is powered by TalkTalk's Future Fibre, which has now arrived here in Manchester. Future Fibre broadband is ultra-fast and ultra-reliable, and with speeds up to a whopping 900 megabit, it's fast enough to handle anything you throw at it. Plus, you can connect over 75 devices at once, so bye-bye fighting over the Wi-Fi. As if it couldn't get any better, Future Fibre plans now come with an Amazon Eero mesh router, so you get the latest in Wi-Fi 6 tech for free. To see if your postcode can get Future Fibre, search TalkTalk Future Fibre now. Welcome to another Couple with Carol podcast, kindly sponsored by TalkTalk. Today, I've got the pleasure of chatting to a local man who's had a lengthy career in show business. He's appeared many times in popular shows such as Emmerdale and Coronation Street, and he chronicles his career in a new book called Imposter, which we're going to talk about today. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Jim Whelan. So welcome, Jim, and thank you for talking to me today.
Hello, Carol. Nice to see you and nice to talk to you.
And you. I know you've got a great many interesting stories to share and obviously hence your book, but maybe we should talk about the title to start off with. You've called your book Imposter. Why was that?
Well, when I started writing it a couple of years ago, I tried to find a title, and I've always felt like an imposter. I've never felt like an actor, and I've always had that dread that the first day on set or going to rehearsals, even for Panto, that somebody would come up and tap me on the shoulder and say, hey, you're not an actor, go on, get lost. And this stems from my insecurity and from my early poor childhood when I never had any sense of self-worth. I've never been to drama school. I don't think I'm a great actor or anything like that. It's just something that I've wanted to do and that I've carried on doing. So I've always felt like an imposter. And in fact, since I looked it up, I find that this is quite common amongst actors and entertainers. I didn't realise at the time, honestly, but a lot of us feel as if we're imposters, you know, so that, hence the title.
I mean, I must admit, I'm in a very small way a writer, and think it's true of many sort of artistic things, isn't it, that you're always thinking that you've done the thing, whatever it is, whether it's acting or writing or whatever, and that you'll never do another one. Is that kind of how you feel about, you've done it right and that's wonderful, but oh gosh, the next one's going to be as difficult?
Yes, and you can't, or in my case, you can't let yourself think about it too much. I mean, when it was coming up to your lines in Coronation Street, you realise, if you've got any sense, or I realised early on, firstly, that it's not about you. You are there to make the main players look good, because as a small part player, it has to be said that no one except your mother is going to tune into Corrie to watch a vicar or a taxi driver or a bus driver or a policeman. They're tuning in to watch the stars. So you, it's implicit, nobody says anything, but after a while you realize that you are the least important actor on the set. And as long as you realize that, you'll be okay, because it's quite daunting to go on the set. And that's why I've always felt, why am I here? What am I doing here? And you can't let yourself think that it's going to be watched, in one case, by 17 million viewers for the Stephen Karen wedding. You've just got to get on with it and then hope that you've done all right. And you're right that it, you think, oh, okay, that went okay, but I could never do that again. But somehow you do, and you get over the fright and you just get on with it, you know.
Well, I suppose in some ways having that feeling that it's not all resting on your shoulders, although certainly as the vicar, I mean, certainly all eyes were on you, weren't they?
Well, they were in a lot of ways. And yet, as I've said about small part players, the vicar can have all the dialogue, but he's not in shot. So it will start on the vicar saying, "Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today." And then it will go round to the more interesting people. In a funeral case of Vera Duckworth's funeral, they would start on me and then they would go round to Rita and Tyrone and Deirdre and Jack, all crying or acting. And that's the way it has to be. And that's fine, you know, once you understand that.
And it must be an exciting thing to be part of, I imagine, as well.
Oh, absolutely. I never slept the night before. And if you allowed yourself to think about it, it is exciting. And I loved it. And I loved being part of it. And I was a mate of Bill Tarmey. We were club singers together and we first met at a Labour club in Bolton when we were both club singers. He was a much better singer than me. And he was a nice man then. And he was always a nice man, you know. So we'd have a chat and that would make you feel more at ease. I met Barbara Mullaney, as she was, at Oldham Rep in 1972. And my first speaking part in Coronation Street was a year later. So I had a friend there with Barbara and we still remained friends, you know. So it's all part of the experience. I loved every minute of it and it was always exciting.
Well, that's brilliant. I mean, you spoke there about the early days, if you will. You're proud of your Salford heritage, but obviously when we talk about Salford, many people have the Lowry impression of Salford. How did you find it growing up there?
Well, I found it sad when I look back now, although I was never aware of how poor we were. We were dirt poor. My dad didn't like work too much, and my poor old mam had three jobs. She was cleaning up in Broughton Park for 8 hours a day. Then she'd come home and give us our tea and clean up our house. And then when we were all ready for bed, she would sit in front of the fire and she would sew buttons onto a gentleman's trousers for a tailor who lived next door. And each pair she finished, which took a half an hour, she'd get 1 and 6 pence old money, 7 and a half new pence. We didn't care. We were just kids. We just got on with growing up. And opposite where we lived on Great Cheetham Street, many people in Salford will know that Broughton Baths are there now. But prior to the 60s, when I was a kid, that was a croft. It had been bombed the year before I was born. And it was full of gas masks and bombed out houses. And we used to climb into the attics of these and go to school on our own, age 4. So my memories are of no central heating, of course, very poor surroundings. Sometimes it was pumps in the summer and wellies in the winter. And I don't need hearts and flowers here, but it was. And I think of my grandchildren who are kind of middle class compared to that. And I wouldn't wish that on them. And this is one reason why I wrote the book, because, you know, it might be nice if they know that, because it was certainly a different world. But then we are talking 75, nearly 80 years ago. So,
as you can probably tell from my accent, I grew up down south, and you know, many people have this perception that if you're from down south, I mean, the softy southerners. I come from London, but I don't. I come from Sussex, but you know, I have vivid memories of the outside loo and waking up in the morning and having the frost on the inside of the windows.
On the inside, yeah. Yep. Yeah, well, we've swapped places, haven't we? Because I'm now down in Eastbourne looking after grandchildren and other duties for family reasons, and you're up there, up north.
Yes. That's right. How's the South Coast looking these days?
Oh, it's fine. It's fine. It is a different world. We've been down here 6.5 years now, and it is a different world without a doubt. But it's not fair to compare it to post-war Salford or post-war anywhere, really. I have very fond memories of growing up. And when I was 13, I joined North Salford Youth Club and so on. Lots of people on the local sites talk about it, people from the Broughton area. And I started work age 15 on Salford docks. So I know what that was about as well.
Right. So, I mean, there's a lot of camaraderie at that point, wasn't there? People in and out of each other's houses and, you know, and that kind of thing.
We'd never locked up because there was nothing to steal. Nobody had anything, you know.
It sounds like you didn't have a particularly easy time, although, as you say, everybody was in the same boat, really, weren't they? And, you know, we just got on with it, I suppose. Do you think you were a confident boy? I mean, is that going into something like acting? You know, people would imagine that it takes a certain type of person, a certain confidence about someone, or...
No, I wasn't. And it's a dichotomy, if that's the right word, because I was a very unconfident boy, and it stemmed from I used to wet the bed until I was about four and a half. And sometimes I'd get up and go to school on my own. And sometimes I'd be wearing the vest that I'd worn in the night, and the bottom might be a bit wet as the radiators heated up in the class. I would reek. There's no other word for it. And I used to fight people every day because of that. So I went through my childhood thinking that there was something wrong with me, that I was no good. And it wasn't until I first appeared on stage in an amateur play for North Salford Youth Club that I suddenly was walking around confidently saying these lines, not saying I was any good, but I felt different and I wondered why. And it wasn't for years I realised that wasn't me up there. I was playing a character and I was hiding behind it. And so that's how it went. From that day onward, from my first amateur play at North Salford Youth Club, all I wanted to do was be an actor, not be rich, not be famous, just as well be an actor. And to that end, I joined Salford Players and so on, you know. So that's how it started. But I was never confident as a child. I passed my scholarship, went to De La Salle, two unhappiest years of my life, because socially I was out of my depth. And when I was 15, it was indicated that I could carry on and go to university if I want. I came home and said to me, Dad, can I carry on at school, Dad? He didn't give me a clip round the ear hole because I was too big by then, but he said to me, university is not for the likes of you. And I went out and I got a job at Manchester Liners as a clerk in the office. That's the way it was. You just got on with it. So I was never a confident boy, but I always wanted to be an actor because it was an escape for me, that and beer.
Well, the youth club was your escape route, was it? I mean, what was it about acting that sort of attracted you, do you think? I mean, was it sort of thrust upon you, or was it just something that you came across while you were at youth club?
I came across it, but the first play, and I can remember it like it was yesterday, was thrust upon me because the warden, as he was of the youth club, was a sergeant major type of character. And I walked in one night at 7 o'clock. He said, Whelan, I want you to be in my one act play. Be at the office 8 o'clock. So I turned up at his office and there were five other people there and three of them were girls. And by now I was beginning to notice girls. Yes, I've got to say they didn't notice me. So we read the play and he said to us, no, that is terrible. This is what you will do. And he told us how to say every line. He told us where to stand when anyone else was talking. And he told us exactly what to do. And for 3 months, we rehearsed exactly as he wanted. And we didn't know why, but we just did it. And then we entered a competition for all the junior groups in the Manchester area. And we won it by a country mile. But we weren't actors as such. We were just doing exactly what Jack had told us. And many years later, when I saw him, he was a nice enough chap. I said, why were you so hard on us that? He said, I couldn't think of any other way of getting half a dozen urchins to have any knowledge or anything of what the theatre was like. And he was right. I had never been to the theatre, but all of a sudden I felt confident on stage. And I realized later, as I said, that wasn't me. I was hiding behind the character. And I had this exciting feeling about it that I've been chasing ever since. I realized it was probably adrenaline, you know. So I am kind of addicted to the thrill, if you want to call it that, of acting. And so I joined Salford Players, who met at Nursery Street in Pendleton in an old church. And during the first 6 months I was there, I used to get really annoyed because they'd keep talking about this boy who'd been there the year before, and his name was Krishna Banji. And they kept saying, Krishna Banji this. I'd never met him, but his father was an Indian doctor in Salford. Now, this was in the 1950s, unheard of at the time. And then someone came in one day and said, hey, Krishna Banji's gone off to drama school in London and he's changed his name. And somebody said, what's he changed it to? He said, Ben Kingsley. Ben Kingsley was at Salford Players as a kid, as a youth in the late 1950s. So I never met him, but this was the exciting things that were happening round and about, you know, and that's how I started. Amateur theatre was very big at the time because television didn't have such a hold. So amateurs could fill their theatres every week.
Actually, that raises an interesting point. I mean, one thing that's just struck me when you're saying that, it must be quite different acting on a set on television as compared to acting on a stage. It must be a very different experience, I imagine.
It is, exactly. And that's what happened to me, because I just wanted to be an actor. I went to Altrincham Garrick, which was a much more professional outfit. They did a play every month that was 600-seater theatre, and they had a professional director, and his name was Ron Harvey, and he was an actor and worked for the BBC. And he said to me while he was directing a play that I was in, he said, you're not bad for an amateur. I said, all I want to do is be an actor. So he said, phone Zena Sharp. Zena Sharp was an agent. I phoned her and I said, I want to be an actor. She said, yes, darling, so does everybody. I said, but wait a minute, I'm playing the lead at Altrincham Garrick. That was big stuff in the amateur world. So she said, all right, I'll come and see you on Wednesday. See me in the bar. So I did see her in the bar. Eventually, she took me on when I managed to get an equity card. And she interviewed me and said, studio is very different. You will have to start at the bottom, because you've never been in a television studio. So I started as an extra, and I was an extra for 5 or 6 years. So yes, it is a completely different genre. There are lots of differences. You don't project, for instance, in television, because you have microphones coming down to your head, one sewn into the back of your costume. Whereas, of course, in a theatre, in those days, you weren't mic'd up. You had to project to the back of the stalls. So yes, completely different genres, and you've got to go from one to the other and get used to it.
Well, and I imagine much more difficult to get into a character too, because I think in your book you speak about, you know, they often film out of sequence, and so it must be difficult to kind of put the mask on and for a few minutes. And whereas in a play you're inhabiting that character, as you said, you know, hiding behind it, but when you've got to sort of jump in and out of it at a minute's notice, it must be a much harder experience.
Very much so, and especially in soaps now, especially in The Street or Emmerdale, because they shoot out of sequence, as you said, and this is for purely practical reasons. You've got to bear in mind that Coronation Street do 6 episodes a week, and so do all the others. Now, a feature film can last an hour and a half, and it can take 3 months to make, hence the difference. Obviously, a feature film is on a big screen, and they get much better everything. But the soaps have to do 2 feature films a week, if you want to put it like that. So you've got to be in and out of character all the time. And it is a different skill set. And the soap actors have my utter admiration, the ones who have to do it all the time, because it really is pressure. And one woman was telling me that she buried her husband one morning, then she had a scene with him in the Rovers in the afternoon, you know. So the whole thing, it's completely different. You've got to be able to switch on and off like that. Whereas, as you say, in a play, you get into character, you go on, you live that character for your 2 hours, and then you finish. So yes, it's a different skill set in every way, really.
Oh, interesting. I mean, as I say, going back to the Salford days, when you spoke about going to work at the Liners, and can you tell us a little bit about that? How did you find the world of work?
I was a very young 15. My birthday was the end of June. I started work in July, age 15, on the docks. So I used to walk down from the Rialto to the Tower and get the 71 bus along Cross Lane. At the time, there were 3,500 dockers on the docks. And as an office boy, my job would be to go around and collect the dockers' books, bring them back to the office where they would be tabulated. I'd have to brew up for 16 men. And what I've just remembered at the time, in our main office, there were 20 people and 20 desks. And out of those 20 people, 16 of us used to smoke, and including me. And I finished up smoking 60 a day. We were in the office, and there were 16 of those 20 smoked cigarettes. So in the winter, with all the windows closed, you could hardly see across the office. So that's the way it was in those days. The dockers had a hard life, because they would stand in the pool, which was just a plot of ground, and a foreman would walk around a little wall, and they'd all stand there holding up their passbooks. And if he took your passbook, you were working that day. If he didn't, you stayed around or went to a cafe. A lot of the boys used to play football for hours. You'd go back at lunchtime. If there was no work for you, this is the Dockers, not me. You'd get your card stamped, and that's where it came from. You'd get your card stamped, and apparently you would receive some money for that day you've not been working. So they had a really hard life, but there were nearly 4,000 Dockers there at this time. The place was heaving and teeming, and there was the ship Canal Company. I was well looked after there by the other people in the office, but by gum, it was hard work. And it was a shock to the system, suddenly starting work and working 5.5 days a week. You know, Saturdays mornings were included. But it was a great experience. But after 3 or 4 years of that, I thought to myself, I don't like this. And I wanted still to be a performer, actor. I became a club singer to get my equity card. And after a few months, I could earn £10 for a Saturday night, £8 for a Sunday night. My total wages of the job I was earning were £12 a week. So it was a no-brainer. I gave it up. First of all, I went to Butlins and I was a red coat at Bognor Regis. I learnt a lot down there. Then I came back and I became a club singer weekends. Then I still did my amateur theatre, got taken on by Xena. I'm truncating a lot of it now. And I became a small part actor. After 5 years as an extra, my first speaking part was with Barbara Mullaney. And so that's how I earned my living for 40 years. The Docks was fine. It was lovely. And it was part of my growing up.
Right. And you mentioned the smoking there. I mean, I remember my first job, as it were, in a shipping agency down south. And we were very similar, although it was a lot smaller office, that 5 out of 6 people were smoking like chimneys and the walls were yellow. I was interested in your book. You mentioned about something that I think would really surprise people these days about your family smoking habits. Would you like to elaborate on that a bit?
Well, yes, people are amazed at this, but it was just something we got on with. We had a friend, he happened to be Irish, his name was Jimmy Hill. And he said to us one day, I can bring you a cigarette machine. And we said, what do you mean? He said, I'll bring you a cigarette machine. He brought a mahogany machine with 4 places in it where cigarettes went, and you put 2 shillings in and you got a packet of cigarettes out. And he came every Friday and topped it up. So we had our own personal cigarette machine in the house, and we just took this for granted. So it was senior service for me dad, Woodbines for me mum, and for us it would be Benson and Hedges or something like that. And when Helen first read that in the book, my wife Helen, she said, you didn't have a cigarette machine in the house. I said, yes, we did, for years. And I thought everyone had them, but it was only us. Or not so many people had them. And it worked all right. It was fine. He came every Wednesday, emptied all the 2 bobs out, topped them up again, and off we went for another week.
It's quite incredible, really, isn't it, when you think back about things. You mentioned that you were a red coat. How long did that last for you?
Just 1 season. I saw the advert in the paper. I went for an interview and got the job. And I was only about 18 and 19. And in fact, the manager of the Redcoats took a kind of shine to me, and he made me a house captain. So at the time, I was the youngest house captain. There were 4 houses there at Butlins at that time, because I was only 18 and 19. I loved it for a season, but by God, it was hard work. We were up at 7:30 in the morning on first breakfast, and we didn't go to bed until midnight when the Redcoat show finished, you know. And in between, we'd be running donkey derbies. We'd be dancing in the evenings with ladies and so on. So it wasn't easy by any means. And after a season, I'd had enough. I wanted to do my own thing. So I went back to being a club singer. And as I told you, eventually getting into television.
So it wasn't that you didn't have the knobbly knees then?
I must admit, I learned a lot there. Something happened to me in the boxing ring, which, how can I put this? I'm sure happened to a lot of people at a younger age than me. I met a young lady who initiated me into some practices which were not for everybody at the time. And everybody went to Butlins because it was quite romantic. So there were some good things happened to me down there as well, you know.
Bit ironic, yes. They were in the boxing ring, but we'll gloss over that.
Well, I used to share my Shelley with another red coat, and he had a friend back there, shall we say. So I had to go somewhere else, and the boxing room was empty at the time, but it was fine. 3 minutes around was plenty for me.
I mean, we hear about a lot of comedians and singers and that used to do the rounds of Butlins and Pontins or whatever. Did you meet lots of up-and-coming stars on your travels?
I think we did. And in fact, when I was working for Mike and Bernie, when I was their roadie,
That's Mike and Bernie Winters, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, yeah, that'll be a name new to the younger listeners. But Mike and Bernie, at the time, were the second top comedy duo in the country. Second, miles behind Morecambe and Wise, but they were quite big stars in their own right. They had lots of detractors as well, still do have. But when I was with them for 18 months, they had their own audience and they made a lot of money and they were very famous. So they did late night cabarets at Butlins. So obviously I went with them, but all they did would be go in, do the cabaret, do the show, then they'd go home. You know, we were there all the time. And I was at Bognor Regis, which was a long way from Salford. And it was my first time out of Salford for more than a day. When we were kids, our holiday for us was a day at Southport with the Labour Party, you know, from Salford Station on the train.
Right. I'm going to show my age now and say that I presume that was pre-Schnorbitz then.
Do you know, Bernie always had a dog. It wasn't called Schnorbitz. He loved dogs and he always had one. But at the time, it was Mike and Bernie with him when I was there. And he was always fond of his dog. But after I left, they broke up. I don't really know why, but there were always frictions. It happens with a lot of double acts because the so-called funny one is the one everyone likes and the less funny one, people kind of deride him, so he's the baddie. It happened with Little and Large. Poor old Sid didn't get any kudos. Eddie Large got it all. So it leads to friction, and they broke up. And Bernie went for a couple of years with Schnorbitz, which, you know, it didn't really work, but that's the way it went. That's what happened with double acts, you know.
Yeah. Well, do you know, it's funny. I'm going to drop my own name now. So you can catch this one. The day that I was born, they wouldn't let my dad come and see me. Like we say, it was a different world then. But they allowed Frankie Vaughan in. Frankie Vaughan came to see my mum and me when I was born. He was a friend of my father's. Frankie Vaughan and Max Bygraves, my father used to take them fishing down in New Haven. They used to come down for the weekend. He used to take them out sea fishing. So
Frankie Vaughan and Max Bygraves are two of the biggest stars around at the time, weren't they?
They were just starting out at the Palladium, I think, and hence why they let Frankie in, because you know, the nurses were all swooning, I think.
Yeah. But, I used to do the band calls for Mike and Bernie because very often they couldn't get to the venue for the band call, and they kind of trained me up because I had been working in clubs. I could do the act, and I did the band call at the London Palladium for them for a charity show, and it was Jack Parnell and his orchestra. And when we started the band call, I was trying to explain to Jack, I said, the boys will play this tune, then the boys will come on. He said, no, wait a minute. He said, you'll have to do it. So I had to stand on the Palladium stage and do what Mike and Bernie did. Hello, hello, Michael. I said, and then they'll do 10 minutes, then there'll be a drum solo, then there'll be this. So I can say I've appeared on the Palladium stage, you know.
Well, marvellous.
It was only the band call, but, you know, there were people waiting like Leslie Crowther to come and do their band call and so on. So I did my bit there. That's my proud boast. And they were doing the week at the London Palladium at the time.
Right, that's marvellous. I mean, it's still an experience, isn't it, to look out from the stage, you know, to be on the other side of the curtains, as it were.
Yes.
It's quite a remarkable thing. So we've talked a bit about Coronation Street. Birmingham, it's become quite a big part of your life, hasn't it, really, over the years? How many years have you been associated with?
Certainly more than 40. I made my first appearance as an extra playing darts in the Rovers in the mid-60s, 1960s. So that would be 7 years after it started. And there were only about 15 main players then, because there were only two episodes a week. And they were like pop stars. They couldn't go out. They would get mobbed all over the place. And I was an extra for years in it, doing small parts, as I said, like playing darts in the Rovers. Then eventually I got my four lines as Manning Corner Shop. Then I was a small part actor and I got more money, but I had to audition for things. And since then, I've probably made another 50 appearances in the street, culminating, I suppose, in becoming the Reverend Todd. And as the Reverend Todd, I married Stephen Caron. I married Jason and Sarah. I buried Vera. I made a lot of pastoral visits to the street to see Tony and Carla, to see the Platt family for various things. And the important thing for me was I didn't have to audition. They just booked me. So for 5 or 6 years, I was in a very happy position of just doing 6 or 8 or 10 episodes a year. And that recurring doesn't mean regular. You only get paid for what you do, etc. And you never know when your next booking might be. But at least they would just come on to my agent and they would say, Jim, such a date, is he free? And so that's how it started. So I've been doing Coronation Street for more than 50 years now, but the first 5 was as an extra. After that, I was a small part player and I played another vicar. I played the Reverend Pike earlier on, burying Lisa Duckworth. I've played a taxi driver, a policeman. I've played lots of different characters, but people seem to think I look like a vicar. and so I used to always get vicar parts, not just in that, in other things as well. But I've got to say, Coronation Street has loomed large in my life, and I've always been happy to do it. It can be a two-edged sword because you had to be available when they wanted you. I mean, for instance, once we had a holiday for my 60th birthday, our children had bought us a weekend in Prague. And the week before we were due to go, they came. My agent said, I'm sorry, darling, but they want you. Can you do it? Now, I could have said no and gone to Prague for the weekend, but there are 10 vicars waiting for me to step out and they would step in my place. So I might no longer be the Reverend Todd. So I did it and it caused a lot of friction. And really, the money I got from doing it went for paying for our weekend in Prague when we took it 3 or 4 weeks later. But you were always at their beck and call, so it wasn't easy. And you had to be able to do the job. When I was an extra, every now and again, they would give an extra a couple of lines, because if an extra, if you can imagine, walked into the Rovers to order, and they say, just walk in and order some beer. You'd walk in, you'd go up to the bar, and Betty would come out and say, yes, love. And if you were an extra, you weren't allowed to speak, so you'd just go. And of course, it didn't make sense. So they say, OK, just order some beer. So I said, £2 a bitter, please, Betty. Yes, love, thank you very much, and sit down. Now you got paid double for that. The point I was making was not everyone could do it. It sounds easy. You think anyone could do it, but you've got to hit your mark. Your eye line has to be right because you're not necessarily looking at the person you're talking to. You're looking at whatever gives the best camera angle for your face. And you've got to make them look good. You've got to say the lines, make them authentic. And a lot of the extras were retired people and they didn't want to be actors and they had no aspirations. I could do it because I've been an actor by now. For 15 years, so I could do it. I'm not saying I was any good. So they got to know they could rely on you to do it. So I became the speaking postman for a couple of years. I became the Reverend Pike earlier on, and eventually I became the Reverend Todd and stayed the Reverend Todd for 5 years. So I loved Coronation Street, and every time I went down there, I'd have a chat to Bill Charmy, because Bill was still a mate of mine. He never changed. He always said he was just one of the lads, right place at the right time. And that was true, but he had to be able to do the job. And over the years, I thought he became a very fine soap actor, because you can't go into people's living rooms 6 days a week and not know what you're doing. People soon get found out, you know, so it could be just as well that I never got a regular part on it, because they might have found me out. That's me imposter syndrome coming through again, you see.
And you kept on with other jobs in the background, didn't you, to pay the rent, as it were?
Always. We had a mortgage to pay and 2 children growing up. And the best thing I ever did was marrying Helen anyway. I fell in love with a teacher and got married. Her job has been the bedrock of our life throughout our married life of nearly 47 years now. But yes, I always did something else. I had a shoe shop in Prestwich. I used to stand the markets with various stuff. I was a taxi driver mostly for many years, because taxi driving in your own car, private hire, meant you could start and finish when you want. If they phoned up, you'd stop taxi driving, just go off and do 2 or 3 days on the street or Emmerdale or anything, you know. And it led to some funny old things. I was in a high-profile wedding at Coronation. It might have been Steve and Karen. And there was a big splash in our local paper in the Bury Times. And I was driving my taxi the following day after it had been on. And it came over the radio, said, go and pick Mrs. someone up from Tesco. So I said, OK, she was a regular. We knew her. So I drove down to Tesco in Bury. I did a bit of a sweep round the car park. And I was quite near to a hoodie. And he mumbled or grumbled something, but I ignored him. I thought I wasn't that near to him. And I put the lady's bags in the car, and she said to me, do you know what he said about you? I said, no. He said, there's that twit off the telly. He didn't say twit. He had a word that sounds... And you know, that's the kind of thing you had. They thought because you'd been on Corrie or whatever, you were rich and had plenty of money, but it didn't work like that because you might work on Coronation Street, then you might get nothing for 3 months, you know. But I always did other jobs, mainly taxi driving for Blue Line and up and down to Salford Precinct and so on. Very much there was a firm on Littleton Road that I worked for 3 or 4 years. And a lot of the boys still remember me from down there. There were happy memories, but it was a soul-destroying job. I used to pray for someone to come on and give me some telework so they can get away from this, you know.
So looking back over your career, it's still a choice you would make over again, is it, to go into acting?
Well, it is a choice, but I wouldn't necessarily make the same choice for the simple reason of this. I messed up my education because of social pressures and various other things. So I never had a decent job. You know, I finished up selling motor spares after I'd finished at Butlins and got home. And before I started being regular in clubs, I was selling motor spares for 12 quid a week. And I hated that. So I had nothing to worry about giving up to become an actor. Now, I know many, many very fine amateur actors because amateur theatre was big at the time. And one in point was our family solicitor, who Helen used to teach with his wife. And he used to come and watch me wherever I was on. I was at Contact Theatre. He'd come and watch me when I was a professional actor. He came to Oldham Rep. He came to a club once when I was near where he lived. And he said, I'd love to do this. You know, I would love it. And he was a fine actor, but he couldn't afford not to be a solicitor. He had 3 children and a mortgage. And so he was envious in his way of me. But he sold his practice 15, 20 years ago for a lot, squillions of pounds, and is very rich by our standard, you know, and has a big house. So had I been, God forbid, a solicitor or a teacher or worked in a bank, I don't think I would have been able to give that up at a whim and just go off and be an actor, because 90% of actors are out of work at any given time. So although I don't regret it, and I've had some enormous highlights, and I'm very happy and touch wood healthy, I don't think I'd be able to do that if I had a so-called proper job.
Looking back over the years, you've obviously written this book now. What prompted you to do that? How did you find the process of writing the book? Was that easy to do?
I won't say it was easy. I started it 10 years ago and I did half of it up to that time. And I found it quite cathartic, but I couldn't find any publisher to take it on. And then each time I did a job, I'd just jot down a few notes about it and put it on the hard drive. And then when lockdown came, I thought, I'll make an effort at this. So I went through it and I got all the bits together and I wrote them up as best I could. And one thing I am proud of is every word in the book is my own. I mean, nobody's particularly interested in me, but a friend down here in Eastbourne read it and he had had a few books published by a publisher, not self-published. And he said, I'll send this to my man and just see. And the publisher came back, said, I quite like that. Yes, we'll do it for you. We'll publish it. He said, we won't put it in the big shops, because he explained to me that putting a book in Waterstones, you have to guarantee to be able to sell thousands. You have to be, you know, Jack D or someone like that to do that kind of thing. So the book was published, didn't cost me a penny, and I'm very happy. I send it to people now. It's sold quite well on Amazon and so on. I mean, I'm not doing a sales pitch, but I do cruise talks now. I'm off next Tuesday, a week today, is that? Yeah, for 5 weeks to the Caribbean, talking about my 50 years, and I show clips from 50 years ago of Coronation Street and others, and they seem to go down very well. So we get a cheap cruise. So I'm off on a cruise, and it gives you a bit of kudos if you have a book to publish as well, because then they bill you as Jim Whelan, actor and writer, you know. I'm not virtue signalling here, but I've given the money to the local hospice down here from the book, because it was never a money-making exercise. And I found it difficult but cathartic. And once I went to the attic and sat in front of the laptop, I found I could carry on for a couple of hours. And I think the important thing for any aspiring writer anywhere, everyone's got a story, just write it. And I sent it away and it was edited to bits. The editor lady, who was lovely, kept coming back to me saying, Jim, you can't do this. Why have you done this? Why have you done that? For instance, I put 50% of it was in the present tense and 50% was in the past tense. So I was saying something, I went down here, I had been down here. That. So I had to go through it and change all of that. So it's not easy, but it's very satisfying. And the first time you see the finished object is lovely, you know. So I won't say it was easy, but I'm glad I did it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's been fascinating talking to you. I know you've got so many more stories, and obviously if people want to know those stories, they can read your book, which is Imposter by Jim Whelan, and we'll have details of that on the Talking About My Generation website. So I'd like to thank you for chatting to me today. It's been absolutely fascinating hearing your reminiscences of Salford and of your acting career. And I think you've got many more years ahead of you by the sound of it. And keep getting on those cruise ships, that's what I say.
Well, it's very nice of you to say so. Thank you very much, Carol. I do have a deep, deep affection and will never lose it for Salford. Having grown up in Broughton, and I didn't leave Salford until I was 33 when I married Helen, and we only moved to Bury then, and we were there for another 40-odd years. And when I taxi drove, it was around Salford and Higher Broughton and amongst the Jewish community up there, because I know them so well. My first job was aged 9, lighting fires for the Jewish community. Had you heard about that? The people who used to light fires.
Well, oh, that's right. Yes, you mentioned it in your book.
Yes, very quick.
It was new to me.
It was a proper job at the time, and you would go on a Saturday morning and the fire would be set, and then you would light it and switch on or off lights that they wanted, make sure it was lit, and stack it up. Then you'd go back at lunchtime and put another shovel of coal on, go back in the evening and do the same. And then there would be 2 shillings on the sideboard for you, which they never weren't allowed to touch money. And I found out when I was telling a rabbi about this one day in my town, I said, I think I used to light your fire. He said, ah, you were my Shabbos goy. That's what you were. You were a Shabbos goy. And we were all put out of work by central heating being invented. But, you know, that's what the kids did in those days, and we were very glad of the 10 pence.
Right. Well, as I say, it's been really interesting speaking to you. I've really enjoyed it, and I'm sure our listeners will have enjoyed it too. And yeah, and bon voyage. That's all is left to say. I don't envy you at all jetting off to the Caribbean.
Okay. Thank you very much, Carol. I hope I haven't bored you too much. It's been lovely to talk to you.
It's been lovely to talk to you too.
Today's episode of Cuppa with Carol has been powered by TalkTalk's Future Fibre, the UK's fastest and most reliable broadband technology, which is now available here in Manchester. Search TalkTalk Future Fibre to find out more.
Thank you for listening to our latest edition of the Changing the Record podcast. For all previous episodes and for the latest news, views and nostalgia for Greater Manchester, check out our website talkingaboutmygeneration.co.uk.